This is an FCIC interview with Ian Lowitt, formerly of Lehman Brothers. Today is August 25th at 8:30 a.m. I'm Sarah Knaus, also
Thank
from the FCIC, of Joby Dan Gannon, Chris Seifer, and Troy Burris.
It's August 25th, 2010. We are interviewing Mr. Ian Lowitt, formerly of Lehman Brothers. Mr. Lowitt, my name is Chris Seifer. And with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, we were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and deliver a report by the end of this year, December 15th. That statute tells us to look at several things, including any institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of government assistance. It also tells us to look at systemically important institutions and the issue of too big to fail. Those are a couple of the reasons we're looking at Lehman Brothers and therefore wanted to talk to you, given your position at Lehman Brothers at the time. So as I said, thank you again for taking the time to talk to us. Before we get into the substance of Lehman, could you please just briefly summarize your educational and work experience, starting with college?
I did an undergraduate degree in engineering in South Africa at the University of the Witwatersrand, and then I did a master's in electrical engineering after that. In 1987, I went to Oxford in England and did another undergraduate degree in philosophy, politics, and economics, and then a graduate degree in economics. In 1990, I joined McKinsey & Company, a management consultancy in New York, and worked there through 1994. In 1994, I joined Lehman Brothers, initially as the head of corporate development, business and corporate development. I became the treasurer of the firm in 2000. I moved to Europe as the chief administrative officer in 2005. I returned to the United States in 2007 as the co-chief administrative officer for Lehman together with Scott Friedheim. And in 2008, in June, I was asked by Dick to become the CFO when Aaron resigned.
And then when did you leave Lehman?
I remained with Lehman through through the bankruptcy, and then I joined Barclays, and have remained at Barclays since the bankruptcy. So I joined Barclays obviously in September of 2008, and then I obviously remained as the co-CAO through that period. So while I was the CFO, I was also the co-CAO.
And what's your position with Barclays when you joined in September of 2008, and has it changed?
In September of 2008, I joined and was the director of integration for the Lehman Brothers businesses, and that was a role that I retained through the end of 2008. I also was the head of the Transition Services Agreement Organization, so that's an organization which continued to provide services to the legacy Lehman estates who were still utilizing Lehman or legacy Lehman systems and operations. And then in, I think it was April or May of 2009, I joined the Wealth Division of Barclays as the Chief Operating Officer of the U.S. business. Which is a position that I still hold. I have a few additional responsibilities within the Wealth Division, including the Global Head of Business Assessment and Strategy.
Okay. When you returned from Europe in 2007 to be the co-chief administrative officer, do you remember when in 2007 that was?
I returned at the end of December was when I returned from London and, began working in New York January of 2007, but I think officially I was appointed to that role probably October, November, that's to my recollection.
Okay, you said January 2007. Did you misspeak and mean 2008?
No, I would say I was the co-CAO in 2007.
Okay.
So I was really in Europe from middle of 2005 and 2006, and then I returned to the U.S. as the co-chief administrative officer in the beginning of 2007.
Okay.
So I was in that role in 2007 and 2008.
Great. Can you generally describe...
Is that clear? I'm sorry. If
yes, I misunderstood. I thought you said you came back at the end of 07, not the beginning. So generally describe to me your job responsibilities as co-CAO.
So as the co-CAO, I had responsibilities for systems and operations, as well as expense management, including sort of the real estate footprint, and then I had... oversight responsibility for finance as well. And then Scott Friedheim, who was the other co-CAO, had responsibility for HR, for strategy, for legal and compliance, for philanthropy, brand. So we didn't overlap in our responsibilities, although we were jointly responsible for the corporate division.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about oversight for finance, what does that mean?
Well, I think it was about ensuring that finance was treated in a consistent way to the other parts of corporate. So Chris O'Mara, who was the CFO, had a relationship, you know, reporting relationship into me, but he also had reporting into, you know, Joe Gregory and to Dick Full.
Okay.
So when we were doing things like, you know, promotions, or we were doing managing the comp process or the new initiative process, we wanted to make sure that all of corporate was managed in a consistent way and that we were integrated in the cross-divisional priorities that we had set for ourselves.
Did the oversight include oversight of the treasurer function and liquidity management and funding and all that kind of fun stuff?
Yeah, that was part of Chris's responsibility.
And when you say Chris,
when I think when I say oversight, I mean it was. I think of it more as sort of management oversight in terms of administration.
And when you said Chris had that responsibility, you meant Mr. O'Meara, right?
That's correct. I'm sorry, Chris O'Meara.
Okay. Explain to me the circumstances of becoming CFO in June of 08.
Again, I think that you know, Aaron and Joe, you know, resigned from the firm. The circumstances of which really are the, you know, things that, you know, Dick would be aware of. And you know, Dick asked me, you know, to step in and be the CFO. I think on the Thursday, June 12th, and you know, I accepted.
Okay, and then again, just generally describe for me your job responsibilities as CFO.
Well, again, you know, as CFO, and I did still retain my co-CAO responsibilities. You know, I had responsibility for, you know, managing the, you know, the finance function through, you know, through the various reports that I had. Mm-hmm.
As your counsel may have told you, and if not, I'll tell you, one of the things we are focusing on, as I said in the beginning, in terms of Lehman Brothers, is the issue of too big to fail. And as part of that, we've been asking folks at Lehman how funding counterparties were acting throughout 2008, and if and when funding became an issue. Or at least an unmanageable issue. Can you give us your views on one, you know, when was funding becoming an issue? And I know that's a little vague. Two, did it ever become unmanageable for any funding counterparties that were either reducing their exposure or eliminating their exposure to Lehman? Did any of them ever tell you why? And for ones that did not, did you ever have any conversations with them about why they, you know, were not reducing or eliminating their exposures to Lehman? I know that was a four-part question, but if you could generally address that would be fantastic.
Okay. I mean, obviously, the person who's closest to that, is Paolo Tonucci, who, I think can give you a pretty rich sense of that. I'll certainly share with you, my sense as well. I think that, again, my recollection of it is that the funding situation became, more challenging after the third quarter earnings call, and up until that point, it had been, pretty robust, and it was really the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of that last week before the bankruptcy filing when liquidity was more challenged. Up until that point, most of the funding counterparties had remained quite supportive of Lehman. But I think, after the third quarter earnings announcement, that was when I recall there being a sort of shift in sentiment.
Okay.
And the focus for me was on, those counterparties who were important secured funders of the firm. And again, from the funding desk and John Coughlin, and from Paolo, the sense was that was the constituency that was concerned, after the earnings announcement.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I either misheard or we had a glitch in the phone. Who were the important counterparties you were focusing on at that time?
The secured funding counterparties.
Okay.
So those people who were funding us on a secured basis.
Okay.
So receiving collateral and extending cash to us with some haircut.
Right, so primarily the repo guys.
Repo funding counterparties.
Right.
And they had remained, very supportive of the firm. Through the pressures that we've had in the summer.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any conversations with any of the repo funding counterparties in this, post? And when you said third quarter, just so the record's clear, you meant third quarter 2008 and that earnings release on the morning of September 10th, 2008?
That's correct.
Okay.
The majority of those conversations would have happened through the funding desk, so that would have been... John Coughlin and Tom Luglio and others on the funding desk. But those were the people who were talking to the secured funding counterparties on a regular basis.
Did you have any conversations yourself with any of the funding counterparties after the September 10th earnings announcement?
I didn't have conversations with the funding counterparties. I did have, conversations, for example, with... with State Street risk officer, who was one of the, one of the people that I did talk with, and she had indicated to me, that at the end of that week that, if the transaction was not forthcoming over the weekend, that they would, not continue to fund on a secured basis the following week.
And did she say why?
I can't recall her saying why. I think she was just relaying a position that the firm had.
Okay. And do you recall her name?
Maureen Miskovich.
Did you have any conversations with anyone other than Ms. Miskovich from State Street along, similar lines?
Again, I don't recall having conversations of that kind with others. They may have happened, but certainly I was getting information relayed to me from, John Coughlin and others on the funding desk, which were, describing how counterparties who were our repo counterparties were thinking about what they wanted to be doing.
And what were Mr. Coughlin and others telling you? And to the extent you can recall specific repo counterparties, that would be tremendous.
Again, they were relaying very similar sort of sentiments that if, a resolution wasn't forthcoming, they would, not be extending secured financing. And the only counterparty that I recall specifically was Northern Trust that... had indicated to John Coughlin that they would not be that they would be unwilling to fund the following week if there wasn't a resolution.
Do you know if these conversations that you're hearing from the repo counterparties are being passed up the line to the Folds and McDades of the world and the executive committee?
I believe that to be the case.
But you don't know.
I think people were. Again, my recollection is that people were obviously very interested in liquidity and the liquidity situation, and I was keeping Dick apprised of all the conversations that I was aware of, and I believe that Bart and the executive committee were aware, but I don't have a specific recollection of speaking with Bart about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me take you back to some earlier times and events and tell me if they jog any memory bells on any actions by funding counterparties. The first one is the government-assisted acquisition of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan. Do you recall, and I know you weren't CFO yet, you were still the co-CAO and not CFO, but do you recall if there was any issues, let's just term it, with funding following that?
My sense was that, and again, I'm doing this from sort of reasonably hazy recollection, but that I think that right after sort of the Bear purchase, we had an earnings call that Aaron did, and that it was quite well received, and that actually the funding for the firm in the week after Bear was reasonably successful, but again, it's based on a pretty hazy recollection.
Right, okay. What about on June 9th, I think it is, you folks pre-announced two QO8 numbers that I don't think were that well received. And of course, on I think the following Monday, June 12th, is when the management changes are announced, when you replace Ms. Callan, and when Mr. McDade, I believe, replaces Mr. Gregory. Do you recall if there were any funding issues in light of that those events?
Again, I don't have a recollection of there being a sort of negative funding reaction then. But again, I don't have a recollection one way or the other.
Okay.
I don't recall it being a time of liquidity stress.
Sure, and I'm just throwing these out there to see if they jog any memory bells.
That's fine.
Sure, we've seen in some documents that in July 2008, Dreyfus and Federated, I believe, pulled their repo lines to the extent they were financing ABS type securities and were limiting their repo lines to treasuries and agencies and the relatively safer stuff anyway. Do you recall anything like that happening in the July 2008 time frame?
I do recall that there were across the whole street concern about people's ability to sell on ABS securities if they had to take possession of the collateral, and that generally across the street there was less availability for those asset classes. I don't recall it being a sort of Lehman-specific event, but it was something that obviously affected us together with the rest of the street.
And was it affecting Lehman by, as I said, by repo counterparties saying, look, we're happy to still provide financing for treasuries and agencies, but we don't want to be facing ABS and the more illiquid type securities?
Yeah, again, my sense, and Paolo would have a better sort of understanding of this, was that the people on the funding desk, that was accommodated within the capacity that we had from other counterparties. That's my recollection of it.
Okay. What about generally during the, this is not an event, but just over time in 2008, what was JP Morgan Chase as your agent bank for the tri-party repos? Were they requiring, I mean, we know about the September stuff and we'll get to that, but before we get to the week before the bankruptcy, and really before the end of August agreements that were done, was JP Morgan Chase either requiring additional collateral or larger haircuts for any types of securities? We've seen in some documents that it looks like, you know, while Lehman was financing about $180 to $200 billion of collateral through the tri-party repos, that about $20 billion of that, you know, was the illiquid ABS type stuff, and the rest was treasuries and agencies and that kind of stuff. So generally, were there issues in that regard with JP Morgan Chase?
Yeah, I don't recall. I mean, JP Morgan Chase, as sort of our tri-party agent, was, you know, as you know, just, you know, it was facilitating the movement of cash and collateral between counterparties. So in that capacity, it wasn't, at least my sense is, it wasn't looking for sort of more, you know, collateral or haircut. That would have been something that a funding counterparty would typically have asked for a particular sort of asset class. And my general recollection is that, you know, up until, you know, the last week or so, JP Morgan was quite supportive of the firm.
Okay, so let's hop to the last week then. Understanding that JP Morgan Chase was generally supportive of the firm up to the last week, let's go through the last week, and let me just have you, you know, give us your recollection of the events and what was going on, and then I'll follow up with any specific questions.
Well, I think in that last week before the bankruptcy, you know, there was the question of whether we, you know, announced our earnings earlier. That was, you know, a decision that was made. So I think the decision was to announce on the Wednesday, which we did do, and then, you know, the market, I think, was, you know, expecting different, you know, us to be able to announce, you know, potentially a sale or an investment. And was disappointed, and then, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you certainly saw, you know, many of the prime broker clients looking to, you know, reduce their exposures, and, you know, we also were, you know, involved in, you know, the due diligence with Bank of America, you know, on that Thursday evening, with an expectation that a deal would be affected with Bank of America.
Right, but take me through your involvement, if any, with the conversations with the folks at JP Morgan Chase about, you know, the demands for collateral. I mean, you know, we've seen in the documents in the Valukas report, you know, about conversations, I think even the previous week, about, you know, leading up about, look, here's what we're going to say on September 10th, here's what we're going to say to the rating agencies, et cetera. And then when you get into the week of the 8th, you know, the demands are made, some collateral is posted, some more demands are made, et cetera, et cetera. So if you could just take us through that chronology, that would be helpful.
Right. I think I don't recall the exact dates that the meetings took place, but as you described, there was a meeting with some of the senior folks at Chase the week before, where we described sort of SpinCo, you know, they did indicate that there were differences in view of how much risk they were taking on between, you know, what Paolo and Treasury thought the risk that JP Morgan was taking on, and, you know, what the folks at JP Morgan thought the risks that they were taking on. And then there was that was something that was going to get worked through the course of, you know, that week. And then I think, again, as you point out from the report, there was, you know, a demand for, you know, a change in the agreement between Lehman and JP Morgan, which came to Paolo, I think it was on the Tuesday, that I wasn't aware of it on the Tuesday, but became aware of it on the Wednesday. And then there was a call on the sort of Thursday evening with Dick and Jamie, Paolo, myself, and then potentially others on the phone where, you know, Jamie was looking for additional collateral, which, you know, Dick agreed to.
So describe for me that call on the 11th that you folks are involved in. I understand it's yourself, Mr. Fold, Mr. Tanucci, and there was somebody else on that call from Lehman, right?
Well, I think Rajan Cohen was on that call. Was in the room with Paolo and myself, and then there may have been others from Lehman and from J.P. Morgan who were on the phone, but I don't know whether... I don't recall them speaking. And, you know, Jamie and Dick were talking about, you know, Jamie's demand for additional collateral. He didn't want additional collateral, I'm sorry, he wanted additional cash.
Right.
And, you know, Dick was pushing back, and Paolo was also maintaining that that additional, you know, protection wasn't necessary, but Jamie was, you know, quite insistent, and Dick was, I think, trying to be accommodating and in the end agreed to it.
Do you recall whether or not during the conversation anyone from Lehman's side said, you know, are we going to be able to get the cash collateral back the next day?
Again, I don't recall the details of that conversation that well so that I could say one way or the other.
Do you know, I mean, I'm sure you probably know, there's also, I don't know if it was in Palookas or otherwise, but was there any discussion about what J.P. Morgan Chase would do if the additional cash collateral was not posted, and not posted before the markets opened on September 12th?
Again, I don't recall, the conversation that well, but again, the tone of it was of Dick being sort of accommodating to Jamie. So I think that once it was decided that we would, you know, post the additional cash, then we were, you know, working to post the additional cash.
And understanding you don't recall the specifics, do you recall generally whether or not Mr. Diamond or anyone else on J.P. Morgan Chase's side said, we're not going to provide intraday credit on the 12th if you don't post another $5 billion of cash?
Yes, I don't have a recollection of that.
Okay. Were you in the room during the entire call?
Yeah, I think Dick was calling in, and we were in the middle of our due diligence meetings with Bank of America, and you know, I recall, you know, being in the room together with Paolo and Rajan Cohen, both of whom were, involved that evening in the diligence meeting.
Okay. Do you recall if Mr. Fold was on the call during the entire time, since you said he called in?
He called in, and, again, my sense was he was on the phone the whole time. I mean, he was involved in the conversation for the my sense was he was on it for the full time. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall any more specifics about Mr. Tanucci's reasons for saying it wasn't necessary to post additional collateral?
No, again, Paolo would be in the best position to answer that. I was aware that, he contested J.P. Morgan's assessment of how much risk they were running. But I don't recall the details beyond just that he felt that they were overstating how much risk they were running, it was just, and that was his view.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall if Mr. McDade was involved in this telephone conversation?
Okay, I don't recall Bart being involved in that call.
Okay. Okay. Explain to me, please, what your role is during the weekend. Are you at the Fed? Are you at Lehman headquarters? Just take me through your Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
I was at Lehman headquarters for all but one meeting that Bart asked me to join him and Alex Kirk, sorry, Bart McDade, Alex Kirk, and Jim Seary late on the afternoon of the Sunday. So, for Friday evening, Saturday, and for the preponderance of Sunday, I was at 7:45.
Okay, and what are you doing at, before, we'll get to the, when you go to the Fed with, on Sunday the 14th, but what is your role on Friday, Saturday, and I guess Sunday morning at least, when you're at 7:45?
I mean, assisting with, any requests that, were coming through to us, Bart McDade and Alex Cook and Kaushik, were down at Kaushik Amin, were down at the Fed, and occasionally we would get questions from them, and we would provide them with information. To the extent there was going to be any diligence, we were available. But we were really just trying to support the team.
Mm-hmm. So explain to me the Sunday meeting that you go down to the New York Fed for, the circumstances leading up to it, and then the actual meeting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, through the, again, I wasn't at the meetings down at the Fed or in any of the meetings together with Barclays, but obviously there was, on the Sunday morning, we were hopeful that, a transaction with Barclays would take place, and then through the course of, the morning and the early afternoon, and again, this is just based on hazy recollection, it was, apparent that that deal wouldn't come to fruition, and then the Fed asked us to, to go down and meet with, and again, my sense was it was Tom Baxter and a number of other staff people at the Fed, but Sunday was partly about how a transaction might be structured with Barclays and the issues that were associated with that, and then obviously there was the meeting at the Fed on the in the late afternoon.
Right. So the meeting that you attend at the Fed in the late afternoon is after you learned the Barclays deal wasn't going to occur, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what's discussed at, what are the topics of discussion at the meeting?
Well, I think what's discussed at that meeting is Alex Kirk asked the people at the Fed, what is it that they wanted, Lehman to do, and the response was, we believe that the holding company should declare bankruptcy and that we should initiate an orderly wind down of the broker dealer.
And what was the response to that?
Part of it was just the details of how, it was just a discussion of what an orderly wind down of LBI would be, but, essentially what came out of that was, we returned to 7:45 and, informed, Dick, and then obviously there were, the board meetings and the board discussion that ensued.
Was there any discussion when the folks at the Fed said, we think the holding company should declare bankruptcy and have an orderly wind down of the broker dealer, about what the consequences of that would be, and whether or not there was perhaps there should be discussion about other alternatives?
I don't recall that being a sort of topic of conversation at that meeting. Again, Bart or Alex Kirk or Jim Siri might have sort of richer recollections of that meeting, but my understanding was that those conversations or conversations of that kind were happening involving Dick and Tom Russo with various regulators and officials through the course of the Sunday. I don't recall it being a topic of the meeting we had with Tom Baxter.
Okay. During this meeting you're having with Mr. Baxter, do you recall whether or not Mr. Harvey Miller was part of that meeting?
There were a number of lawyers at that meeting. I think Harvey was. I just don't have a strong sense of who they were, but it's possible that he was at that meeting.
Okay.
Again, I recall the the Lehman participants quite well. You know, we traveled down together and traveled back together, and I know there were a lot of lawyers in the room, and it's quite possible it was Harvey.
Do you recall whether or not there was any discussion about the government providing assistance so that the holding company didn't have to declare bankruptcy to avoid potentially systemic consequences of a Lehman bankruptcy?
Again, I just don't recall that being a topic of that meeting. I was aware that there were sort of other meetings or other conversations involving others about that, but again, Tom was, the general counsel I believe that to be the case. He wasn't the person that we were having that conversation with in that meeting, is my recollection.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall if there was any discussions about the primary dealer credit facility being expanded, and in terms of the types of collateral that you could use that would be eligible as collateral to secure PDCF borrowings, and whether or not that would be available to Lehman?
Again, I don't recall that being a conversation point in that meeting with Mr. Baxter, but I do have a recollection that when we came back to 745 7th Avenue, that conversations of that kind had actually taken place, and I believe that Tom Russo had been in discussions with various folks at the Fed with regard to that. So I know that, or I recall that to be something that was considered and we were discussing when we got back from the meeting at the Fed. But again, I don't recall it being a topic of that meeting with Mr. Baxter.
Okay. What do you recall in terms of that topic outside the meeting, other than the meeting with Mr. Baxter, when you guys returned to 745?
Again, my recollection is that there had been conversations, and again, my recollection is that it was, Tom Russo who had led those discussions, and that, that what I understood was that that had been discussed, and then we thought that it, or there was a belief that that would in fact happen, and then on clarification that Tom had engaged with, it was determined that actually it wouldn't be open to us for more collateral types, but that it would be open to the broker dealer on the Monday for the sort of normal liquid securities that LBI held, so that as repo counterparties terminated their or didn't extend their trades with LBI, that we would be able to fund LBI's positions through the PDCF.
Any understanding of why Lehman would not be able to afford itself of the expanded collateral eligibility program?
Yeah, I wasn't part of those discussions, so I don't know why that decision was made.
Do you recall, not just limiting it to the PDCF, but do you recall any discussions about whether or not the Fed would make a loan to Lehman to keep the business open, and any discussions in that regard about whether or not there was sufficient collateral to support such a loan?
Don't have any recollection of that.
Okay.
It may have happened, but I just have no recollection of it.
Can understanding that one, Lehman was not going to be able to have access to finance, you know, other types of collateral through the PDCF. At least that was the understanding that we're hearing from you and other folks were talking at Lehman. And that repo counterparties were telling you folks at the end of the week that if there wasn't an acquisition, you know, they weren't going to want to provide financing. And I think you also said earlier that prime brokerage account customers were moving their positions to, out of Lehman to other places. What kind of discussion was there, if any, within Lehman on the weekend about whether or not, regardless of the government's directive to file bankruptcy, could Lehman have opened and funded itself on Monday the 15th? Was there discussion about that?
I don't recall specific conversations, but I think the sense that existed was that with all of those pressures, that the firm would not be able to fund on the Monday.
Were you present on the 14th of September during the board meeting?
I don't recall if I was there for the whole of the board meeting, but I do recall being, you know, at the board meeting on the Sunday.
Okay. Can you take us through your recollection of the board meeting?
One thing that I do recall is that Chris Cox, who was the head of the SEC, was anxious to be to have an opportunity to talk to the board, and was sort of passed through so that he could speak to the board telephonically, and he urged the board to move to sort of rapid resolution.
Did he tell the board to file bankruptcy?
I think he was. I mean, my recollection is that he was pretty careful in the words that he selected. You'd have to speak with the other board members, who I think would be in a better position to say how they felt about it. But my sense was he was careful in how he spoke.
And understanding that he was careful with how he spoke, what was your impression?
I mean, I think, my sense was that the message that he was delivering was consistent with what we heard at the Fed, which was that there was a view that the holding company should declare. But again, I recall him being, my major recollection is that he was very careful that he wasn't actually saying that specifically.
Right. But is it accurate to say that your impression was that the message was consistent with the message you heard earlier in the day down at the New York Fed, and that was holding company files bankruptcy, attempted orderly wind down of the broker dealer with the PDCF?
Again, it's really hard for me to say that. To put myself sort of back at that time, and it's just difficult. I mean, he was keen to see sort of resolution. He was careful on what he said, but just the fact that he wanted to have an opportunity to speak to the board, I think, was in itself sort of telling. But I really can't say he was delivering a message that was as specific as implied in your question.
Mm-hmm. And putting aside, or not putting aside, but in addition to recalling Mr. Cox addressing the board during the board meeting, can you just take us through what else happens at the board meeting?
Again, I think it's a pretty lively, My sense was that there was a real discussion among the board members about what they should do and what their choices were, and how they were, and what it was that Lehman should do.
Were there discussions about whether or not Lehman would be able to fund itself the next day if it didn't, it chose not to file bankruptcy?
Yeah, I think that you know, that came up as a topic, and I think I would have, you know, expressed the sense that I did have based on the conversations we'd had with the various funding counterparties that, you know, even the strongest supporters of the firm historically were looking for a transaction that weekend and that would, you know, probably not fund us on a secure basis if a transaction hadn't been consummated, which it didn't, it wasn't going to happen.
And did you actually address the board during the board meeting and make those types of comments?
Again, I don't have a firm recollection of it, but I believe it's likely that that's what happened.
Okay.
Again, I just don't remember it that well, but I do believe that that's what happened based on.
Okay. What was there any, to the extent you recall, do you know if anybody on the board, you know, wanted to not file and see what happened on Monday?
Yeah, I don't have a. I just don't recall the discussion among the board members that well to determine that. I mean, obviously, you know, the board minutes would, I imagine the board minutes would reflect that conversation.
Okay. Do you recall if during the board meeting, or even not just limited to the board meeting, but did you have any discussions with folks within Lehman about what the consequences of a bankruptcy might be? And I don't just limit that to Lehman. I mean, I mean sort of the overall consequences of a bankruptcy.
Well, I think that, you know, I was certainly, of a view going into the weekend that a transaction would happen. So really we didn't spend, I don't recall spending a lot of time thinking about, what the implications of bankruptcy would be, in part because we were working so hard to try to get a transaction, you know, consummated, and my focus was on, you know, diligence and keeping the firm sort of operating. So I don't recall, sort of detailed conversations about, or any conversations about, you know, what the implications of bankruptcy would be, because we were really working towards, you know, a transaction and believed that a transaction would in fact be effective.
And is that the case following, learning that the Barclays deal wasn't going to occur, and that the Fed and, you know, Mr. Baxter and Mr. Cox were saying we think the best thing to do is for the holding company to file?
Well, at that point, again, I don't want you to put words in my mouth about what Mr. Cox said.
I understand. My words.
No, that's fine. I mean, I think at that point, you know, we were, you know, consumed with what it actually took, which is with the mechanics of the filing and what it was that we would need to do the following day. I really took the thrust of your earlier question to be, you know, did I spend time thinking about the systemic implications of a bankruptcy filing? And really, I was very focused that weekend in trying to, you know, ensure that a trade took place rather than thinking about bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. And understanding that's what your focus was, I mean, just to the extent you recall, I mean, do you recall whether or not there were discussions that you were a part of, you know, and particularly it seems like it would happen probably more so after the Barclays deal falls through, about, you know, systemic implications of a bankruptcy?
Well, I know that, you know, my recollection is that, you know, Eric Felder had spent some time thinking about that, and that, you know, those views were communicated, you know, to Bart and to Tom Russo, and I believe those would be communicated more broadly. But as I say, my role around it was much more around trying to see how a trade could get affected and the more operational details.
Mm-hmm. We've heard from some other folks, although we haven't seen the document, that apparently there was a PowerPoint presentation prepared that included some slides about what the implications would be of a bankruptcy. Do you have any knowledge of that document?
I actually have seen that document, but I didn't generate it. But I do recall it, you know, seeing a document subsequent to the bankruptcy filing, which described, in a few pages, what those implications were likely to be. But again, I didn't generate it. I don't know who put that together. I thought it was sort of Eric Felder, because I know he thought about those issues, but it might not be Eric.
Right. Was it you had mentioned someone earlier, a Mr., and I'm sure I'm going to butcher it, a Kozinski
or
Kaushik?
Kaushik, I mean. Kaushik, again, I'm sorry I can't be more helpful about who generated that, but, you know, Bart McDay, Alex Kirk, and Kaushik Amin were down at the Fed. And again, Eric Felder, I know had thought a lot about the implications of a failure of Lehman. But I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful about, you know, who generated that material.
And do you know if Felder went down to the Fed with those folks too?
Again, I don't know. It's possible that he did, but again, I just don't know.
Okay.
Mr. Lowith, this is Joe Biedengannon. Can you please describe your interaction with the New York Fed and the SEC between the Bear weekend and the Lehman weekend?
Interactions with the Fed and with the SEC.
The New York Fed and the SEC, that's correct.
Okay. I think that the majority of my interactions with the U.S. Fed with the New York Fed would have been around the liquidity stress test work that the Fed asked us to do, and then the meetings that we had at the New York Fed regarding that. Those were meetings that involved Dick Bowles, Aaron Callan, Chris O'Mara, Tom Russo, and myself. And then with the New York Fed, it was Mr. Geithner and a number of staff members, one of whom was Sandy, and I'm sorry, I'm just blanking on his surname. And those were meetings where, the Fed had described a stress test. They asked us to run, the Lehman number through the stress test, and then there were sort of follow-up meetings to sort of clarify what those numbers were. That was the majority of my interactions. I didn't have sort of separate conversations with Mr. Geithner. Those were conversations which would have all been done with Dick Bowles or with Tom Russo. And then at those meetings, Eric Seary was there representing the SEC. Mm-hmm. And there were a few calls that I had subsequent to those meetings with Mr. Seary, usually together with Tom Russo, just to discuss, the Lehman liquidity. But, the way I would characterize my dealings was I was largely dealing with sort of the staff. I wasn't the person dealing with the principals. That was really Mr. Fuld and Mr. Russo.
Do you recall how many times you met at the New York Fed to discuss the liquidity stress test?
I don't recall. I do recall a meeting in July and a follow-up meeting to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did have another meeting with some of the staff folks from the New York Fed, I think on the Friday before the third quarter earnings call, where we took them through the SpinCo concept and gave them a preview of the earnings for the quarter.
Can you add a little more color on the liquidity stress test? I know in the Veloukis report it states that the New York Fed implemented a Bear Stearns and a Bear Stearns Lite stress test, and that Lehman failed it, but then when you ran your own stress test, you did pass that test. Can you just provide the atmospherics as to those tests?
Sure. I mean, I think that, Paolo Tannucci is the, he's probably the most knowledgeable about this, but, my sense of it was that it was really the way in which the Fed had interpreted our numbers that led to a sense that there was a liquidity gap at Lehman, and that when they understood the Lehman numbers somewhat better, they got comfortable that actually we did pass the test, and that was something that was confirmed to us. It actually at that meeting that Bart and I had together with the staff folks at the Fed when we discussed SpinCo. So I think it was, the sense was that the test itself was being refined as a result of the discussions that the Fed had with each of the various firms, and that, part of what they were also looking to do was to, understand, the data submissions from each of the firms in a better way. And I think, again, my recollection of it was that it was sort of the overfunding of collateral that that needed to be sort of described better to the Fed staff members so that they could apply it appropriately in their stress test.
Do you recall what the stress test entailed?
I think broadly what it assumed was, reduction in secured funding capacity and an inability to issue any short-term unsecured debt. But again, I don't recall all the details that well. Mm-hmm.
And did anything concrete come out of those tests? Or
I think that what emerged was that the Fed communicated to us that they were comfortable with our liquidity position.
Mm-hmm. And during your meetings at the New York Fed, or any interaction at all, did you ever discuss the idea of a bank holding company?
There was a separate work stream away from this discussion, which was led by, Tom Russo, about establishing a bank holding company.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Tom also included an external law firm, but I'm sorry, I don't recall which law firm. So, Tom would be in the best position to describe the bank holding company. My recollection of the meetings we had on liquidity with the Fed didn't go into the question of the bank holding company, but you're right that was an initiative that was underway and that Tom Russo led.
Did the New York Fed ever disclose to you that they were considering replacing J.P. Morgan during that summer in case decided not to unwind?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Were there any ideas disclosed that the New York Fed could possibly replace J.P. Morgan as the intraday clearing bank?
I'm not aware of that, and we had the question had been raised internally about whether there was any possibility of shifting our clearing and tri-party away from J.P. Morgan, and I think the quick assessment was that the amount of migration work involved in that would be absolutely enormous, and it just really was not a practical thing for us to consider. But I'm not aware of any discussions with the Fed about J.P. Morgan being no longer being the clearing bank for Lehman. Again, I have no recollection of it.
Okay.
Do you recall what led to the discussions about, considering moving away from J.P. Morgan Chase? I assumed a Boney. Why did those discussions come up in the first place?
I think it was just, again, I don't recall it specifically. I think it was just it was, and again, I can't even recall who raised it. It was just raised as a possibility, and it was seen to be just too, you know, just impractical.
Well, I understand that, you know, it would be an enormous task and impractical in terms of doing it, but what was there dissatisfaction with J.P. Morgan Chase? I mean, what led to the consideration of it in the first place, if you know?
Again, I would be sort of speculating with regard to that, but I think to the extent that somebody would raise it, it would probably be more about seeing, you know, J.P. Morgan as a sort of competitor in a way that, you know, Boney was not a competitor of the firm.
Right, okay.
Do you recall having any problems with J.P. Morgan throughout that summer? Was there ever a threat that it would not unwind, for example?
Paolo would be the one who would be, you know, dealing with, Paolo Tanucci would be the one who would be dealing with J.P. Morgan on a regular basis. And my sense of, you know, of that time period was that, you know, while, you know, mindful of the risk that they were running as a firm, that J.P. Morgan were trying to be helpful to Lehman, you know, through that summer. So it's possible that there were, you know, there were sort of friction points. Again, Paolo would be in the best position to describe those. But my general sense of, you know, the overall relationship was that through most of, you know, through that period, J.P. Morgan were trying to be helpful to Lehman.
And in your discussions with the New York Fed, the SEC, or any regulator, did you ever get a sense, or did they ever convey to you explicitly or implicitly a willingness to let Lehman fail or go into bankruptcy throughout that summer?
Again, I was not part of the, you know, senior relationship calls, and the meetings that I had were, as I say, with staff members, and that didn't come up, and I wouldn't have expected it to.
Okay. How about Citibank? Go ahead.
I have no recollection of that ever coming up as a conversation point in any of those meetings.
Throughout that summer and into the week coming to the bankruptcy, do you recall any problems with your clearing relationship with Citibank?
Well, I mean, I do recall that with Citi we were, you know, we had issues with, you know, CLS, but I think that those were on the Sunday evening of the bankruptcy filing, and then in the subsequent week.
And on June 12th, I think that was the day you were announced as the new CFO, it appears that Citibank had asked for a comfort deposit. I think originally they had asked for $5 billion, and it was reduced to $2 billion. Do you recall that interaction or negotiation?
Again, I am aware, you know, maybe through, you know, reading the various reports, that took place. And again, that would have been something that, you know, was managed, you know, by Mr. Tanucci. I don't recall being involved in, you know, in that discussion specifically.
Did you think back then that the demand was reasonable, or?
I mean, I think that, you know, we, you know, as a general matter, often put money on deposit with different banks. I mean, my sense of that deposit was it was just sort of part of our liquidity pool that was, you know, on deposit with Citi. It didn't have, there weren't restrictions on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it clearly was a time where people were, you know, more nervous about, you know, exposure to Lehman, and they were, you know, while they were keen to be helpful, they also were looking, you know, they were also, you know, focused on risk to a greater extent, possibly, than they had been before.
Mm-hmm. Now that once they come into the Lehman bankruptcy, I believe that's September 10th, it appears that both J.P. Morgan and Citibank amended operative agreements, clearance agreements with Lehman. Were you involved in those discussions?
Again, you know, Paolo Tanucci was leading those efforts. You know, he would typically inform me of, you know, of what was going on. But again, I was not involved in, you know, the details of of those negotiations. I just don't have a recollection of being involved in the details of those negotiations.
Do you recall signing any of those amendments?
Again, I may well have, but I don't have a recollection now of signing them specifically.
Do you recall whether you thought that those demands were reasonable from both J.P. Morgan and Citibank?
Again, I can't recall my sense of, you know, at the time of whether I thought they were sort of reasonable or not.
As you know, our next hearing is focused on Too Big to Fail. And coming to that Lehman weekend, I know you probably have heard that Secretary Paulson said that there will be no public financing for Lehman. Nonetheless, during that Sunday when you were told to file bankruptcy, were you surprised? Were you expecting that the government would somehow come through for you?
Again, I sort of went into that, you know, that period after the earnings announcement, believing that a transaction would take place, you know, with Bank of America, and then when Barclays entered, the picture, you did see at certain points that a trade with Barclays would in fact be affected, and I think my expectation was that. That a transaction would actually take place that weekend, and I guess I was, I don't recall it now thinking back, but I was almost certainly surprised that no solution other than bankruptcy had arisen. But again, I just can't recall my state of mind at that time that specifically.
And what's your understanding as to why the Barclays transaction failed?
Again, I wasn't involved in the negotiations or the meetings, so I don't have sort of first-hand information about that.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing the stuff secondhand at 7:45, it seemed as though, initially the issue was whether there would be a guarantee of the Lehman trades, which was not forthcoming, and then there was an effort to get the FSA to make certain waivers, and again, that wasn't forthcoming.
And do you recall how you first became aware that Lehman had to file bankruptcy?
Again, I assume it was. I didn't have a recollection, but I assume it was after the board meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess my last question is: I just want to get your views as to why you think Lehman failed.
I mean, I think, Lehman lost the confidence of the market, and, in a confidence-sensitive, industry where you're relying on, other counterparties to, extend financing to the firm, if you lose the confidence of the marketplace, you can't continue to operate.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you believe Lehman lost the confidence of the market?
Again, it's sort of, it's hard to really say. I think that after I think the market was expecting in the earnings announcement, more than was provided. I think they were hoping that, some M&A transaction involving a capital-rich counterparty would be announced, and I think that it's we're disappointed when something like that wasn't forthcoming.
One of the things we've seen in the documents, many of them public, frankly, and in the interviews is, going back to the 2Q08 earnings release and 3Q08, the company was reporting some fairly substantial asset write-downs. And, of course, you had Einhorn out there, claiming that the assets were still overvalued, two. And then three, we've seen, or at least reported in the Veloukis report and otherwise, that a lot of the folks in there looking at Lehman as a potential acquisition target
Either one, you know, thought the assets were still valued too high, or two, just didn't want them just because of concern about value. And then four, that private consortium deal over the weekend, you know, I was reportedly coming up with lower values and was going to ring fence those and provide financing to try to get a deal with a Barclays or a B of A done. And we have seen in sort of, you know, some of the reactions to the September 10th release that it looked like investors were either expecting, you know, more specifics on this SpinCo idea, either in terms of how it was going to be financed and whether it really was going to get these assets off the books, or as you had mentioned earlier, an announcement of a either a strategic investment partner, if not an out-and-out acquisition of the firm. But all of it, from, you know, what we've been looking at, seems to stem in large part from concerns about asset valuations and what that meant to the current or eventual solvency of the firm. Is that consistent with what you were viewing the market concerns were, or is it something different or something in addition to that? What's your comment on that?
I think that what I'm sort of drawing attention to is, you know, realistically the liquidity, the funding, the secured funding element, which was, you know, the willingness of, you know, our secured funding counterparties to continue to fund the firm. I mean, clearly the points that you raised are ones that were out there in the marketplace. You know, there's obviously big bid offer spread associated with some of the illiquid assets, and I think part of the rationale for SpinCo was, you know, to capture that on behalf of shareholders rather than to sell out a series of sort of very idiosyncratic assets sort of at distressed level. But, you know, it's the gestalt of the things that you described that I think was, you know, at play in the marketplace.
Mr. Lowett, thank you very much for your time. I don't think, in fact, I know we don't have any more questions at this time. I'll tell you what I tell everybody. When we get to the end of these interviews, we'll talk amongst ourselves, look at our notes. If we figure out we forgot to ask something, we'll contact your counsel for a quick follow-up call, but I don't think that will be necessary. Thank you all for your time, and we'll be in touch if necessary.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks. Bye-bye.